Welcome to Presenting Alfred Hitchcock Presents, presented by the Ann Arbor District Library. I'm Al Sheridsma. Before COVID, I was a regular visitor to the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival in Hot Springs, Arkansas. And when I first started going there, the films were shown in an old movie palace called the Malco. At this time in its life, the Malco was divided into two theaters, one of which still had an old-time balcony. That's where I usually sat when I attended movies in that particular theater. Another person sitting up there in the balcony was the projectionist, because even 20-some years ago, things had gone digital and the big film projectors were no longer necessary. So instead of using the projection booth, the projectionist sat with his equipment at the base of the balcony, and I would chat with him on occasion. One of the films that was shown back then was called Alone Across Australia, and it was a chronicle of John Muir's walk across Australia from south to north, filmed by himself along the way. He is not entirely alone because he is accompanied by his dog, Seraphine, a Jack Russell Terrier, except that along the way, Seraphine eats poisoned bait set out for dingoes and dies. It is a heartbreaking moment as he films and we watch his grieving and then his burying of Seraphine before he goes on truly alone. It is a tough moment to watch, and people were upset. They were horrified that such a scene existed in the film, and they complained to all sorts of people working at the Malco about it, including to the projectionist. I discussed it with the projectionist after I saw the film, and he said, yes, it is a very tough scene to watch. But what were we supposed to do? Put up a sign that says, warning, dog dies? I leave it up to you to decide whether you think that would be appropriate or not. As for me, I brought up that story only to say that in this episode, Miss Paisley's cat, warning, cat dies. Now here's Hitch. He is standing at a butcher's block, wearing an apron and using a cleaver to mince meat.
Oh, good evening. The leading man in tonight's saga is an alley cat. He must be fed before each performance. It keeps him from eating the actors. Today he's having a finely chopped mice burger. Naturally, we use nothing but contented mice. For 2 weeks, they have been fed nothing but tranquilizers. Now, just as soon as I can feed our star, you shall see our story, Miss Paisley's Cat.
So here's Miss Paisley's Cat, first broadcast on December 22nd, 1957, starring Dorothy Stickney. Teleplay by Marion Cockrell, based on a story by Roy Vickers, and directed by Justice Addis. This is Dorothy Stickney's second and last Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance after Conversation Over a Corpse. This is Marion Cockrell's ninth of 11 teleplays after Into Thin Air, Santa Claus and the 10th Avenue Kid, There Was an Old Woman, Who Done It, co-written with her husband Francis Cockrell, Wet Saturday, Conversation Over a Corpse, co-written with Norman Daniels, The Rose Garden, and the West Warlock Time Capsule. Her next is Miss Bracegirdle Does Her Duty, episode 18 of season 3. And this is Justice Addis's ninth of 10 directing jobs after Salvage, A Bullet for Baldwin, Safe Conduct, Nightmare in 4D, The Night the World Ended, Martha Mason Movie Star, The West Warlock Time Capsule, and The Indestructible Mr. Weems. His next and last is our next episode, Night of the Execution, episode 13 of season 3. We begin with an establishing shot of Miss Paisley's apartment, showing us a kitchenette fronted by a table with two chairs. There are decorative dishes on shelves and displayed on the wall. And to our downstage right, an ornate lamp, all of which gives the impression, including Miss Paisley's very clothing, of an earlier time. Miss Paisley, played by Dorothy Stickney, is serving herself dinner, and as she does so, she talks to herself.
Oh dear, there's a spot on the table. What would Papa have said? Must have been something hot. How could I have been so careless? Papa always told the servants there is no excuse for carelessness. Even when one is always alone, it doesn't do to let down. Papa always said a lady behaves like a lady, whether anyone can see her or...
And so we learn that Miss Paisley comes from a wealthy family and had a father who was a very strong force in her life. Now, though, while she clearly has objects and furniture, including that table, from her previous life, she now has no servants, no papa, and lives very modestly in a small apartment. But what she does have now, out of the blue, is a cat. We get a close-up shot as the cat enters an open window, pushing his way through some floral ruffle curtains onto a table there, with another antique, ornate-looking lamp. The first thing the cat does is start licking the table, so I suspect that something delicious was placed there, perhaps some of that chopped mouse meat that Hitch was preparing to get him to enter through the window to begin with. But we're really not supposed to notice that. So let's get back to Miss Paisley.
How on earth did you get here? Oh, animals aren't allowed in the Piedmont apartments, so you must go. Go, please. Shoo! What an ugly cat. I don't suppose anyone ever wants to stroke you. Well, I suppose you may stay for dinner.
We get a long, slow fade to black, and when we fade in again, things have changed. Miss Paisley, now dressed to go out, is at her front door, hugging the cat, whom she has named Stanley. And clearly, Stanley now lives with her.
Goodbye, Stanley. Now be a good, good kitty. Or be as good as you can. And do try to stay out of trouble.
You can hear Stanley purring there. He is clearly enjoying the contact. Miss Paisley makes her way down the long staircase to the first floor, her shadow cast on the wall as she goes. But she is met, before she gets to the first floor, by Jenkins, the apartment manager, his shadow meeting hers.
Good morning, Miss Paisley.
Good morning, Jenkins.
Excuse me, miss. Would that striped cat be yours by any chance?
It is my cat, Jenkins. I realize he's not supposed to be here, and I'd be very glad to pay you $1 a week for any trouble he might be to you.
Oh, that's very kind of you, miss, and thank you.
Miss Paisley thinks this conversation is over and takes one step down, preparing to leave. We get a nice, quick cut here as the camera suddenly moves in closer on the two of them, as Jenkins halts her by getting to his point.
But what I was going to say was, I saw it jump out of Mr. Rindich's window with a bit of food in its mouth. You know what Mr. Rindich is.
I know he's a bookmaker and a vulgar man.
Yes, miss, he sure is. He's a violent man too, miss. That's what I wanted to say.
Yes. Yes, I understand. I shall give Stanley raw meat. Then he won't steal.
Jenkins has these moments of slight smiles to let us know that he's enjoying this, and he looks after Miss Paisley as she passes him, also with that same smile. We're supposed to get the impression that Jenkins is not a nice man, but it's hard to feel that way because Jenkins is played by our old friend Harry Tyler, This is his ninth of 11 appearances on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, after Premonition, And So Died Rhea Buchinska, Place of Shadows, Portrait of Jocelyn, Decoy, Momentum, Alibi Me, and The Dangerous People. His next is The Right Kind of House, episode 23 of season 3. Now, after Miss Paisley walks past, we dissolve back to her apartment with a medium shot of the raw meat that she is preparing for Stanley. She pokes it a bit with a knife. It's hard to tell exactly what it is, perhaps raw liver. It doesn't look very appetizing. And the camera shifts away from Miss Paisley and finds Stanley, who is sitting on top of the refrigerator. We cut back to Miss Paisley as she puts on her leather gloves in order to deal with the raw meat.
See, Stanley? I wore these gloves when I used to ride during my holidays from school. They're the best leather. Papa always bought the best of everything. Now, I hope this will discourage you from sneaking into Mr. Rindich's apartment, Stanley. That man is not fit for anyone, not even a cat, to associate with. The other people in this building are common. They cannot help that. But he is also vulgar. And that is a matter of character.
As Miss Paisley cuts, the camera is positioned just so that we do not actually see the cutting. This is in keeping with the various acts of violence that eventually take place in this episode. We never see any of them either. We then quickly cut to Stanley up on the refrigerator and follow him as he jumps down to the counter and begins eating the meat. Miss Paisley tells him that she has a present for him. It's a collar.
You may not like it, but it's for your own good. See? It says $5 reward for return, and it gives our name and address. Now let me put it on you. Now don't fuss. You brought this on yourself.
We dissolve to Miss Paisley returning home. She exchanges pleasantries with Jenkins, who is hanging out by his door. And then we cut to Stanley fleeing out of Mr. Rindich's apartment, followed by Rindich's foot. Miss Paisley and Jenkins watch Stanley race up the stairs, and she decides to have a talk with Mr. Rindich. We get a shot down the hall with the stairway, Miss Paisley and Jenkins in the background as she walks towards Rindich's apartment. Jenkins stays in the background, clearly amused by all of this. Miss Paisley knocks and knocks again.
Yeah?
You kicked my cat.
Your cat, is it? Well, I thank you to keep it out of my apartment.
I regret the trespass.
I do, too. But if I catch him in here again, you won't have no cat.
This is all one long continuous shot as Miss Paisley, after Rindich slams the door in her face, walks back down the hallway towards Jenkins. We follow her. She tells Jenkins she's going to complain about Rindich for cruelty to animals. And Jenkins tells her Rindich won't care about any fine.
He's a bookie, you know. He gets fined many times as part of his business expenses.
How revolting.
You'd be surprised the cash that he handles. The night before a big race, he'll be home with that bag of his stuff full. Then he'll go out around 8 and do his round of the bars and be back at 10 with that much again.
The amount of the fine is irrelevant, Jenkins. This is a matter of principle.
Principle don't mean a thing to Mr. Rindich, miss.
Stanley, are you all right?
And Jenkins again looks amused at her concern. Now, Rindich will remain an important figure in this episode, but we won't see him again. So let's take a look at Fred Graham, who played him. He was working in MGM's sound department and playing semi-pro baseball when he was hired to tutor Robert Young and Nat Pendleton in the MGM baseball murder mystery, Death on the Diamond. He also doubled as Nat Pendleton in the catching scenes. That was the beginning of a 40-year career as a stuntman and actor, during which he doubled for Clark Gable and Nelson Eddy at MGM, and in doubling Basil Rathbone in The Adventures of Robin Hood, broke his ankle. He moved to Republic Pictures, where he specialized in their westerns and serials. He met John Wayne there, and he ended up coordinating stunts with him in 26 films. Director William Whitney called him the best screen brawler I've ever seen. And Fred himself said, "My ideas to make fights look good on screen were to stay loose and relaxed a little distance from your opponent and throw punches. Never throw a punch at chin level because a good take makes it look like a miss. Throw the punch at the opponent's eye level because a good take makes it appear like it's right on the chin. Design your routines for 30 to 40 seconds of screen time, leaving room for close-ups on the stars." His acting career included small roles in the 1935 version of Mutiny on the Bounty, the 1936 version of Romeo and Juliet, Reap the Wild Wind, My Favorite Spy, Passage to Marseille, The Razor's Edge, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, Samson and Delilah, The Asphalt Jungle, The War of the Worlds, Demetrius and the Gladiators, and The Alamo. He didn't get a name in most of his performances, but he was Sheriff Jim in The Giant Gila Monster.
You would have no reason to know about this, but there's been a lot of livestock missing lately. One here, one there. That doesn't make headlines, but now it's people.
And you think there's a tie-up?
I don't know. What we need is a criminal investigator, and headquarters won't send one down here.
Well, maybe they will now.
Yeah, maybe. Did you notice those skid marks? Just like the others, straight across the road. If it had been hit by another vehicle, the paint would be knocked off. What batters a car around like it was a toy?
A giant Gila monster. His TV roles included episodes of The Lone Ranger, The Roy Rogers Show, Gunsmoke, The Life and Legend of Wyatt Earp, Wagon Train, Sergeant Preston of the Yukon, Have Gun Will Travel, Wanted Dead or Alive, M Squad, Perry Mason, and the thriller episode, The Fatal Impulse, playing Sergeant Hannigan.
Killers don't advertise in advance.
Oh, no. That's theory, Mr. Wiley. Sometimes they do. Hannigan here can tell you about sweet old Mrs. Krause.
Yeah. She wrote letters to her relatives telling them they were going to be poisoned.
What happened?
They got poisoned.
Oh.
In 1968, Fred went to work for the Arizona Department of Economic Planning and Development of Motion Pictures. And IMDb says he had more to do with bringing filming to the state of Arizona than anyone else. Fred Graham died in 1979. 16 days shy of his 71st birthday. This is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance, but he is a detective at the end of Rear Window.
Doyle! Creel! Give me a 38!
It's a plastic!
Sorry, Jeff, I got here as fast as I could.
And he's the policeman who falls off the roof trying to save Jimmy Stewart at the beginning of Vertigo. We move outdoors to see Miss Paisley walking down the street with three extras behind her, whereupon she notices Stanley entering Mr. Rindich's apartment through an open window. All of this would have been avoided, including Miss Paisley even getting Stanley to begin with, if the Piedmont Apartments had believed in putting up window screens. But they don't. So here's Rindich, who, according to Jenkins,
"The night before a big race, he'll be home with that bag of his stuff full. Then he'll go out around 8, and do his round of the bars and be back at 10 with that much again.
And yet this man lives on the ground floor and leaves his window wide open. He also has his bed right next to that open window, which seems to be what attracts Stanley. He is lying on it when Miss Paisley reaches in and grabs him. But Stanley breaks free and encounters a dog who has pulled the leash out of his owner's hands to confront him. There's a fight, which we hear but do not see. And Stanley seems to come out ahead. The dog owner catches up to his dog, and he and Miss Paisley have a chat.
I'm sure sorry, ma'am. He jerked the leash right out of my hand. Sure hope he hasn't hurt your cat.
On the contrary, I'm afraid my cat may have injured your dog. I'm very sorry. If there's anything I can do...
Oh, that's all right, ma'am. He asked for it and he got it. Your cat knows how to take care of himself, all right. Get in under and strike up.
Oh?
Okay. Get in under and strike up. Maybe there is a reason for this scene after all.
I have some iodine in my apartment.
He don't want none of that. Maybe your cat has saved them from losing an eye to the next one. Don't give it any more thought.
You're very kind.
Thank you. Good day.
Good day.
The dog owner was played by Mark Sheeler. He was born in New York City, and Grokopedia.com says that photography remained his lifelong passion from an early age. Spinning off of that, he was an aerial photographer in the Air Force during World War II. And following the war, he used his GI Bill to earn an engineering license, and he became a radio DJ. So that in the late 40s and early 50s, he hosted the popular radio show The Blues Chaser Club, mixing music and comedy. He then moved on to film and television, appearing mostly in B-movies and schlocky horror films, including Apache Warrior, Tank Battalion, Speed Crazy, and Why Must I Die? Grokopedia says that his credits illustrate his work as a dependable supporting player in the modest productions that characterized much of Hollywood's output at the time. There is one film that stands out from the rest, From Hell It Came, in which he plays Eddie. Not because it's good. On the contrary, it's mainly known at this point for having a clip in the horror clip film It Came From Hollywood, and for winning a Golden Turkey Award. It's the film with the walking tree monster known as a Tabanga.
It's Terry.
You're the best shot, Eddie. Have you got enough light to see?
This moonlight's good enough.
All right. Let's try for that knife. Maybe if you can hit that knife with a bullet, it'll drive it clear through the monster's heart.
No!
It has to turn to give me a crack at that knife, Doc.
Fire a few shots, maybe it'll turn around. No effect on it at all. Try again.
I'll aim above her. Doc, I never saw anything like this. Those bullets bounce off like BB shot on a stone wall.
That knife's our only chance.
In the early 60s, he left the movie business, and he spent almost 35 years as a professional wedding photographer and a supervisor for the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. But he did appear in the late 90s in an episode of Mad About You and in a number of TV commercials. Mark Sheeler died in 2015 at the age of 92. This is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance. So Miss Paisley returns to her apartment, where she finds Stanley entering through the window.
Oh, my dear, What a fright I've had. And I didn't know whether you were hurt or not. Oh, I'm so glad you came in. That huge dog. Oh, Stanley, I was so proud of you. You knew just how to defend yourself. Get in under and strike up. Oh, Stanley, do be careful. I don't know what I'd do if anything should happen to you.
Well, that's our regular music signaling the commercial, but it does seem to be coming at an ominous time. And sure enough, we return from the commercial to find Miss Paisley entering her apartment with Stanley nowhere in sight. And it's not a matter of just missing him recently.
It's been 24 hours. How can you treat me this way?
She goes in search of him, winding up down in that alley where Mr. Rindich's window is. She peeks in, the window still wide open, and she finds next to the bed a garbage can. And within the garbage can is Stanley's collar. She rushes inside to talk to Jenkins.
Stanley, my little cat, is missing, and I just saw his collar in the waste paper basket in Mr. Rindich's room.
What a pity, miss.
Jenkins, you must investigate this at once. It's your duty.
Yes, miss. I sure hate to do this, but there's something I think you should see outside, in back.
Jenkins takes her to an outside area where all the garbage cans are, and he lifts up the lid of one of them to show her. We don't see what's inside, but Miss Paisley certainly does. And by her reaction, and by the music, we know what she sees.
He was in Mr. Rindich's room again soon after you come home last night. You shouldn't really be surprised. He was bound to do it sooner or later.
Maybe he didn't do it. Maybe that wasn't his collar I saw.
Oh, yes, it was, miss. When my wife went in this morning to straighten up his apartment, she spotted the collar in the wastebasket.
Wait a minute. Jenkins has a wife?
She said the strap part had been cut, like maybe with a razor.
Well, I did warn you. And now that Stanley is gone, let's take a look at who played him. This is actually his second appearance on Alfred Hitchcock Presents, but I don't think I mentioned him the last time. And his name is not Stanley, that was the character's name. His name is Orangey, although sometimes he was billed as Rhubarb, the name of the character he played in his cinema debut. This is an article from TheGuardian.com of February 5th, 2026, by Jesse Hassinger, entitled Perfect Casting, Is Orangey the Most Important Movie Cat Ever? And subheaded, A New Retrospective Celebrates the Work of the Cat, Credited with Roles in Breakfast at Tiffany's, The Comedy of Terrors, and Rhubarb. And the article reads, In the midst of Oscar season, it becomes evident just how much work it takes to win an Academy Award, both in on-screen work and off-screen campaigning. Consider, however, that multiple actors have won more than one Oscar. Emma Stone, one of this year's Best Actress nominees, won twice in the past decade. Only a single cat, meanwhile, has twice won the Patsy, the Picture Animal Top Star of the Year, the award given by the American Humane Association, not to be confused with the Humane Society, was discontinued in 1986. That cat is Orangey, the subject of a small retrospective at New York City's Metrograph Cinema. Plenty of rep houses will play a movie like Breakfast at Tiffany's around Valentine's Day. The Metrograph is going deeper into the Orangey catalog for a wider variety of titles and genres. Breakfast at Tiffany's does offer Orangey his most famous role, the rather less colorfully named Cat, pet of Holly Golightly, played by Audrey Hepburn, who calls him a poor slob without a name. Orangey features heavily in the film's climax, when Holly releases her pet into an alley as she prepares to leave town, only to have Paul, George Peppard, rush to retrieve him. It completes a running thread that Cat is part of Holly's wildness, as well as her potential domestication. What better animal, of course, than one equally prone to draping himself over his makeshift mistress and making yowling leaps around her apartment? The Audrey Hepburn classic won Orangey his second Patsy. His first was for a bigger role in Rhubarb, a comedy from a decade earlier about a cat that inherits ownership of an eccentric rich man's estate, including a Brooklyn baseball team. This sounds like a proto-Air Bud. There's nothing in the rulebook that says a cat can't own a baseball team. But Rhubarb appears to have been made with adults, at least nominally, in mind. It's a 50s screwball comedy, which is to say it's pokier than its classic-era counterparts from a decade earlier and feels padded out, if still amusing, at 95 minutes. Still, Orangey steals plenty of scenes, even more than in Breakfast at Tiffany's. This cat leaps heedlessly between furniture items, at one point parking himself atop a chandelier. He's far more memorable than his agreeable two-legged co-stars. Human stars do maintain one advantage, though. There is only one Audrey Hepburn, and there are admittedly somewhere between 2 and 40 Orangeys. At least two cats actually played Cat in Breakfast at Tiffany's, and in general it's difficult to draw any straight lines across Orangey's biologically feasible but logistically questionable 16 years of credits. Deeper research into his career tends to lead to conflicting reports. Filmmaker and critic Dan Sallet wrote a bit about Orangey for Filmmaker magazine, locating a passage from the book Amazing Animal Actors, explaining that the making of Rhubarb actually involved recruiting a whopping 60 different but similar-looking cats. The movie is in black and white, so perhaps a precisely matching hue was not a great concern. And selecting 36 particularly trainable cats, each doing an assigned trick, to create a single composite performance. This only defies belief in that, as much as Rhubarb the Cat does in the movie, I'm not sure we see 36 distinct tricks. A contemporaneous New York Times article puts the number of Rhubarbs at 10, though director Arthur Lubin does describe a principal cat who bit him, prompting the director to retaliate with a shrewd kick while the Humane Association representative wasn't looking. This does seem compatible with the Rhubarb character, who is largely disagreeable at first. Watching the cat performances, both within the movies and across the different titles, certainly lends credence to the idea that Orangey was more a cat type, provided by trainer Frank Inn, than a specific animal. Two films in the Metrograph retrospective showcase Orangey's genre versatility. He supposedly has a small role in the Western Stranger on Horseback, and more of a supporting role in the horror goof The Comedy of Terrors, both films directed by Jacques Tourneur, who also, appropriately enough, made the 1942 classic Cat People. That was before your time, Orangey. But despite the shared director, these two cats seemingly aren't much alike in temperament or performance style. The animal in Horseback lounges around a lawman's office like an unbothered and casually cuddly bodega cat. The one in Terrors, made when Orangey would have been at least 13, zips around with the vigor of a cat half his age. Maybe he was invigorated by the prospect of sharing scenes with an all-star cast of horror icons, with Vincent Price, Basil Rathbone, Boris Karloff, and Peter Lorre on hand. This may be Orangey's most stacked ensemble, due respect to Ms. Hepburn. It's more fun, of course, to imagine Orangey embarking upon a singular 16-year career, rather than flitting in and out of random scenes from various films. In that sense, his spiritual successor is the Orangish cat from Inside Llewellyn Davis, also played by several felines, described by director Joel Cohn as a pain in the ass. As Cohn says, dogs often want to please people, cats have little such interest, which of course only winds up drawing our attention further. It's like watching a baby in a movie. You're struck by the cuteness, and then perhaps by the uncanny sensation that for a moment you're watching someone on screen who cannot actually be acting in the traditional sense. For the babies and the cats, the scenes are real, regardless of whether they involve absurd plots, murderous funeral directors, or fake socialites, and also regardless of whether the cat in question cares at all. Even the most intense adult human actors are pretending. Orangey, in all of his indeterminate forms, actually lives the movies. So let's say for our purposes that Orangey was one cat. His other film credits include This Island Earth, The Incredible Shrinking Man, Darby O'Gill and the Little People, Under the Yum Yum Tree, The Diary of Anne Frank. and Fluffy. He's in episodes of Gomer Pyle, USMC, and I Dream of Jeannie. And he's Mr. Henderson in the Dick Van Dyke Show episode, Where You Been, Fassbinder. He's in two episodes of The Fugitive and Petticoat Junction, three episodes of My Favorite Martian and Batman, four episodes of Our Miss Brooks, and 18 episodes of The Beverly Hillbillies. Of the anthology shows that we love so well, he is in the Twilight Zone episode, Night of the Meek.
Listen, you moth-eaten Robin Hood. The wholesale theft of thousands of dollars worth of goods is not a slight discrepancy. Though I can tell you right now, Corwin, this whole affair comes as no surprise to me. I perceived that criminal glint in your eye the first minute I laid eyes on you. I'm not a student of human nature for nothing.
Seems to me that you've put your finger on the problem, Mr. Dundee. This bag doesn't know whether to give out gifts or garbage.
And the Outer Limits episode, Soldier.
CO. Qualo Clobredny Bright. RMENTNDO reporting.
Cat.
Remember the book?
What did you want from that cat, Corlin?
Nothing sane.
Oh, cats are different where you come from?
Different. See, old Prowler, think, speak.
I don't understand. The commanding officer uses cats?
On patrol. Troopers, cats tied together by think, speak. Cats do prowl, spot the enemy. Troopers jump.
His previous appearance on Alfred Hitchcock Presents was in episode 17, The Older Sister. Of his performance here, CinemaCats.com says that he steals the show in his scenes. Looking like a rough-and-tumble alley cat, Stanley has an irresistible on-screen charm, making it very believable that Miss Paisley would take him in and care for him. Orangey died in 1967, at the age of 17. This is his second and last Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance, but he does appear in one of the best episodes of the Alfred Hitchcock Hour, An Unlocked Window, which is episode 17 of season 3. So Miss Paisley returns to her room, distraught over Stanley's murder. She picks his milk dish up off the floor and talks to herself. As she does so, she goes to her closet, pulls out a raincoat, and puts it on. Then she puts on her leather gloves, and she looks down on the kitchen counter to see the knife with which she was cutting Stanley's raw meat.
Mr. Rendich is a beast. No. No, he's much worse. You were the beast, Stanley. A dear, good little beast. And Jenkins is a cruel man. I can see that now. He's always mocked me. I think he was hoping this would happen. It excites him to see us suffer. It is now 8:05. In less than 2 hours, Mr. Rendich will come home. You could defend yourself against other animals. But I taught you to trust human beings. And I couldn't defend you against them. I've allowed myself to become excited. I must be calm. I must be calm.
very calm.
This is where she sees the knife, but instead of picking it up, she pulls back. She sits in a chair, and then we crossfade to her still in the chair, waking up from a sleep. The room is dark now, and she is no longer wearing her raincoat or gloves.
Strange. I don't remember turning up the lights. Good heavens. It's 4 o'clock. Almost daylight. Wonder I'm so tired.
We fade out and fade up on an interesting shot, a strange angle looking down the stairs as Jenkins is being led down by a policeman. There's someone standing at the top of the stairs, and the camera pulls back to show him, one of Miss Paisley's neighbors, and she comes out to see what's what.
What is all this noise about?
The bookie on the ground floor, miss. Somebody cut him up with a knife last night. The cops have arrested Bob Jenkins. They took him away in handcuffs.
I see.
Hey, Myrtle!
We don't get to see Myrtle, but the neighbor is played by Joel Smith. IMDb provides credits for him, ranging from his first appearance in the TV series Front Page Detective in 1951, up to his final appearance in the TV series Daniel Boone in 1968. In between, he's an officer in Rebel Without a Cause, a reporter in The Court Martial of Billy Mitchell, a forestry officer in The Court Jester, and a flight engineer in Violent Road. He's in 4 episodes of Navy Log and 8 episodes of Space Patrol. The most cringeworthy one may be his role as the Native American Yellow Feather in the episode Evil Spirits of Great Thunderbird.
Is there a leader among you?
Me, Yellow Feather. Son of Chief Eagle Claw. You spirits from Great Thunderbird?
Thunderbird? Yes. We were sent from the great beyond. We are good spirits. Rise. Rise, Yellow Feather. We have a message for you. You must take us to your father, Chief Eagle Claw. He must gather many warriors. There are evil spirits following us, and they must be destroyed.
Yellow Feather, lead way to Wigwam of Eagle Claw.
You'll also find him as Smitty, James Whitmore's Jeep driver, in the closing moments of the giant ant drama, Them.
Mike! Jerry! Are you there?
Yes, we're here!
Smitty! They're alive!
They're alive.
Tell Mrs. Lodge her boys are alive.
Just like in the nest in New Mexico. Report that to O'Brien. Tell him I must be near the nest. And I'm in a bind with the kids. I can't use the flamethrower. They're right in the line of fire. So tell O'Brien to send in troops.
Peterson says it has the same smell as the nest in New Mexico. Brood odor, he calls it. He has asked for troops to be sent in.
He's found the nest.
To all units. To all units. Condition red. Drain 267 is the target area. Repeat. Condition red. Drain 267 is the target area.
I don't have any other information about Joel, except that this is his only Alfred Hitchcock Presents appearance. So, Miss Paisley returns to her apartment and tries to think.
I must try to remember. Get in under and strike up. I went out. I returned. $5 reward for return. Return. Oh. Oh, please help me. please. I must have committed murder.
And so it appears that Miss Paisley calls the police, because when we dissolve to later, she has two men, an inspector and a uniformed officer, with her in her apartment. And these are both men we have seen before. The inspector is Raymond Bailey in his fifth of 10 Alfred Hitchcock Presents and one Alfred Hitchcock Hour episodes. After Breakdown, The Case of Mr. Pelham, Portrait of Jocelyn, and The Three Dreams of Mr. Finlater, in which he was in the intro with Hitchcock. His next is Sylvia, episode 16 of season 3. And the policeman is David Armstrong in his second and last appearance after The Dangerous People, in which he played one of the asylum attendants. He's also in the Hitchcock-directed Suspicion episode 4 O'Clock, again as a policeman. Miss Paisley tries to convince these men that she committed the murder. The inspector tries to convince her otherwise.
Do you really think that you killed a man while in a state of trance because you believed he had killed your cat?
I knew he had killed my cat. Jenkins showed me the cat's body, and I myself saw my little cat's collar in Mr. Rindich's waste paper basket.
Well, then that collar should still be in the basket, shouldn't it?
Naturally.
There was no collar in the basket, Inspector.
The inspector has a couple more questions.
At what time did you kill him?
I don't know. I have no memory of the act itself. I can only say that it was fixed in my mind that I must get close and strike upwards.
How did you get in?
Again, I can't say. I must have got in through the window.
The inspector has been standing up before Miss Paisley, who has been sitting down. He is in the dominant position. But now he sits down next to her, giving up his dominant position, and by the very sitting reveals that he doesn't think that Miss Paisley had anything to do with this.
Now, we accept the fact there's a period you don't remember in which you have done various things, but I don't believe that you killed Rindich.
What about the knife? I can identify it.
And so can dozens of people. It's a very common kind of knife, Miss Paisley. Any hardware store has sold hundreds of them.
But my knife is gone.
Miss Paisley, if you had entered Rindich's apartment and done everything you said, your fingerprints would be all over the place.
I was wearing leather riding gloves.
This bit of news unsettles the inspector for a moment. We can see it on his face. A nice acting job by Raymond Bailey. But he soon recovers.
May I have a look at them, Miss Paisley?
They're gone. And the raincoat, too.
Well, what raincoat?
My gabardine raincoat. I was wearing it and the gloves when I sat in that chair to wait for Mr. Rindich to come home. When I came to, they were gone. You don't believe me.
Well, I believe that you believe it all, Miss Paisley. You felt that you had to kill the man who had killed your cat. But you knew you couldn't face up to a job like murder, especially with a knife. So you had a brainstorm, or whatever you want to call it, in which you convinced yourself you had committed the murder.
Okay, that makes a certain amount of sense. That could be what happened. Now, though, Miss Paisley has a question for the inspector.
Even if I can't prove that I did it, why do you think Jenkins did it?
At 7 o'clock this morning, before the murder was discovered, a police officer found Jenkins trying to sink a bag in the river. Now, that bag belonged to Rindich. He had collected money in it and kept it overnight. And Jenkins has more than $500 in cash that he can't account for.
Oh, yes. Jenkins was always interested in Mr. Rindich's money. Well, he must have discovered the body and been unable to resist the money. I suppose he thought he could get rid of the bag, hide the money, and the police would think that the murderer had taken it.
Miss Paisley is entirely correct here, but the inspector says...
And that's exactly what we do think, miss.
So he and the officer leave, but not before the inspector tells her...
Just relax, and after a while, the whole thing will come back to you.
And in this case, the inspector is entirely correct. We move forward in time, with Miss Paisley telling us... precisely how far we've moved ahead.
I still miss you, Stanley. Though it's been 6 months. 6 months and 3 days.
She moves over to her chair and pulls out her knitting, all the time ruminating on how she might get a new kitten.
A very young one that I can train so it won't...
And at that moment, she drops her knitting needle behind the cushion of the chair. And when she pulls the cushion up to pull it out, she finds...
$5 reward for
Stanley's collar.
Now I remember everything. I took it out of the basket afterwards. I didn't want to get blood on it. So I took off my glove. I took the collar out of the basket and put it in the front of my dress. Then, yes, I put on my glove and went out the window to the river. That's where the coat and knife and glove are.
Whoa, wait a minute, Miss Paisley. Not the knife. The knife was left at the scene, remember?
What about the knife? I can identify it.
And so can dozens of people. It's a very common kind of knife, Miss Paisley. Any hardware store has sold hundreds of them.
But in all other respects, Miss Paisley, again, is entirely correct. So what is Miss Paisley going to do?
Oh, I must tell that nice inspector. What a pity poor Jenkins has already been executed.
Wait a minute. Jenkins has been executed? After 6 months and 3 days? That is some fast justice. Or in this case, that is some fast miscarriage of justice. As Miss Paisley previously said of Jenkins...
But it does seem a little hard on Jenkins, undesirable as he is.
So Jenkins was undesirable. He clearly enjoyed Miss Paisley's discomforts, and he tried to steal Rindich's money after Rindich was killed. But does that make him worthy of execution after 6 months? How are we supposed to feel about this? And don't forget, there's one character we never see who's only mentioned once.
When my wife went in this morning to straighten up his apartment, she spotted the collar in the wastebasket.
So Jenkins had a wife. There was a Mrs. Jenkins. What has become of her with her husband falsely convicted and executed? Well, we never find out. Because really, as far as Miss Paisley is concerned...
But the new superintendent is much nicer. Almost a gentleman, in fact.
So we end on a humorous note, I guess, as Miss Paisley puts her coat on and exits her apartment. But what is she going to do? Is she going to turn herself in to the inspector? Or does she decide it's too late with Jenkins executed and all? Well, we know how Hitch will handle it.
Unfortunately for Miss Paisley, murder will out.
And we'll get to that a little bit later. But it does sound like Hitch doesn't think Miss Paisley went to the police. So let's go to the source. Miss Paisley's Cat by Roy Vickers was first published in the May 1953 issue of Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, and it came in second place in the magazine's 8th annual First Story Contest. It begins, "There are those who have a special affection for cats, and there are those who hold them in physical and even moral abhorrence. The belief lingers that cats have been known to influence a human being, generally an old maid, and generally for evil. It is true that Miss Paisley's cat was the immediate cause of that emotionally emaciated old maid reaching a level of perverted greatness or stark infamy, according to one's point of view. But this can be explained without resort to mysticism. The cat's behavior was cat-like throughout." So that start does not give us a very flattering portrait of Miss Paisley, but let's see where things go from there. For one thing, as opposed to the episode, where all we got was...
told the servants there is no excuse for carelessness.
We get a complete description of Miss Paisley's life. Miss Paisley's cat leaped into her life when she was 54, and the cat itself was probably about 2. Miss Paisley was physically healthy and active, an inoffensive, neatly dressed, self-contained spinster. The daughter of a prosperous businessman, her mother had died while the child was a toddler. She had passed her early years in the golden age of the middle classes, when every detached suburban villa had many of the attributes of a baronial hall. If there was no tenantry, there was always a handful of traditionally obsequious tradesmen, to say nothing of a resident domestic staff. She was 18 at a finishing school in Paris when her father contracted pneumonia and died while in the course of reorganizing his business. Miss Paisley inherited the furniture of the house, a couple of hundred in cash, and an annuity of £120. So yes, the story takes place in England. Her relations in different parts of the country rose to the occasion. Without expert advice, they pronounced her unfit for further education or training and decided that, among them, they must marry her off, which ought not to be difficult. Miss Paisley was never the belle of a ball of any size, but she was a good-looking girl with the usual graces and accomplishments. In the first round of visits, she accepted the warm assurances of welcome at their face value. Yet she was not an unduly conceited girl. It was her father who had given her the belief that her company was a boon in itself. The technique of the finishing school, too, had been based on a similar assumption. During the second round of visits, in units of some 6 months, she made the discovery that her company was tolerated rather than desired, a harsh truth from which she sought immediate escape. There followed an era of nursery governessing and the companioning of old ladies. The children were hard work, and the old ladies were very disappointing. Penuriousness and old ladies were turning her into a humble creature, thankful for the crumbs of life. In her early 20s, she obtained permanent employment as a female clerk in a government office. She made her home in Rumbold Chambers, Marpleton, about 15 miles out of London, and about a mile from the house that had once been her father's. The Chambers, in this sense a genteel Edwardian word meaning flatlets, had already seen better days and were to see worse. The rent would absorb nearly half her annuity, but the Chambers, she believed, had tone. The available flatlet looked over the old cemetery to the 17th century bridge across the river. She signed a life lease. Thus, she was in that flatlet when the cat came 32 years later. She had taken out of the warehouse as much furniture as would go into the flatlet. The walls were adorned with 6 enlarged photographs, somewhat pompously framed, of the house and garden that had been her father's. The radio came into general use. The talkies appeared, and civil aviation was getting into its stride, events which touched her life not at all. Light industry invaded Marpleton and district. Every 3 months or so, she would walk past her old home until it was demolished to make room for a factory. If she made no enemies, she certainly made no friends. The finishing school had effectively crippled her natural sociability. At the end of her working day, she would step back 30-odd years into her past. When the cat appeared, Miss Paisley was talking vivaciously to herself, as is the habit of the solitary. The cat is described like this. The stare of Miss Paisley's cat was not pleasing to humanity. It was, of course, a normal cat stare from eyes that were also normal, though they appeared not to be, owing to a streak of white fur that ran from one eyelid to the opposite ear, then splashed over the spine. A wound from an air gun made one cheek slightly shorter than the other, revealing a glimpse of teeth and giving the face the suggestion of a human sneer. Add that it had a stiff left foreleg, which made its walk ungainly, and you have a very ugly cat, a standing challenge to juvenile marksmanship. So Miss Paisley adopts the cat, and she has the conversation with Jenkins about the cat being in Mr. Rindage's room. Miss Paisley knew that he was a street bookmaker with a number of runners who took the actual bets, and that Jenkins stood in awe of him as the only tenant of any financial substance. As opposed to the episode, Miss Paisley fights against any sort of feeling of companionship with the cat. On the third day of the fourth month, the cat failed to appear at its mealtime. Miss Paisley was disturbed. She went to bed an hour later than usual, to lie awake until dawn, struggling against the now inescapable fact that the cat had become necessary to her, though she was unable to guess why this should be true. She tried to prove it was not true. She knew how some old maids doted upon a particular cat, perpetually fondling it and talking baby talk to it. For her cat, she felt nothing at all of that kind of emotion. She knew that her cat was rather dirty, and she never really liked touching it. Indeed, she did not like cats as such, but there was something about this particular cat. And so when the cat returns, she determines to get him a collar. And in the story, the cat scratches the collar off a number of times over a number of days before she gets him to accept it. And we are told even when it scratched the collar in the course of scratching itself, it made no effort to remove the collar. it wore the collar for the rest of its life. Which sounds nice enough, except we'll soon find out that the rest of its life is rather short. What follows is the scene with Mr. Rindich kicking the cat, and with Jenkins telling Miss Paisley that it wouldn't do any good to get Rindich fined. But here, Miss Paisley also goes to a lawyer, which she also did in the episode, but we didn't see it. We just heard of it in passing.
How can I make you realize, Stanley? We're helpless, Stanley. Helpless. He's a dreadful man, and we've no recourse in law. We can't prove anything. The lawyer said we'd be laughed out of court.
But he failed to perceive the principle. He told her that she could not prove her statements, that as the cat admittedly bore no sign of the attack, the case would be laughed out of court. She had never heard that phrase before, and she resented it, the resentment being tinged with fear. Back home, she witnesses the cat attacking and killing a mouse. She was without the physiological fear of mice, thought them pretty little things, and would have encouraged them, but for their unsanitary habits. Now, Miss Paisley knew, certainly from the cliché, if not from experience, the way of a cat with a mouse. Yet it took her by surprise, creating an unmanageable conflict. Don't! Oh, don't! Stop! Can't you see? We're no better than Mr. Rindich. Oh, God, please make him stop. I can't endure it. I mustn't endure it. Isn't it any use praying? Are you laughing, too? Physical movement was not at Miss Paisley's command just then. The feeling of cold in her spine turned to heat and spread outwards over her body, tingling as it spread. In her ears was the sound of crackling like the burning of dried weeds. Her breathing ceased to be painful. The immemorial ritual claimed first her attention, then her interest. After some minutes, Miss Paisley tittered, then she giggled. The cat, which can create in humanity so many illusions about itself, seemed to be playing its mouse to a gallery and playing hard for a laugh. Miss Paisley laughed. We have the scene where Miss Paisley finds the cat on Rindich's bed and the scene in which the cat attacks the dog. And, if you're wondering why I don't call the cat Stanley, she never defined that relationship, had not even observed the oddity that she had given the cat no name. And so Rindich kills the cat. Here we have a rather unsettling description that you may want to skip. In the hall, Mr. Rindich's voice reached her through the closed door of his apartment, apparently swearing to himself. There followed a muffled whistling sound as of cord being drawn sharply over metal. Then she heard a queer kind of growling cough and a scratching on woodwork, the kind of scratching sound that could be made by a cat's claws on a wooden panel if the cat's body were suspended above the floor. And then the next day, Jenkins comes to her and tells her he wants to show her something. "Good evening, madam. I hope I'm not disturbing you. There's something I'd like to show you, if you can spare a couple of minutes." On the way downstairs, there broke upon Miss Paisley the full truth about herself and Jenkins. "Madam!" She could hear now the contempt in his voice, could even hear the innumerable guffaws that had greeted his anecdotes of the female clerk who gave herself the airs of a lady in temporarily distressed circumstances. But her dignity had now passed into her own keeping. He led her along the corridor, through the door giving onto the yard, to the 6 ash cans. He lifted a lid. On top of the garbage was the carcass of her cat. Attached to the neck was a length of green blind cord. "Well, Jenkins?" Her fixed smile was unnerving him. "He was in Mr. Rindich's room again, soon after you came home last night. You can't really complain, knowing what he said he'd do. And hanging an animal isn't torture if it's done properly like this was. I don't suppose your poor little pussycat felt any pain. Just pulled the string over the top of the coat hook, and it was all over." That is immaterial. She knew that her cold indifference was robbing this jackal of the sadistic treat he had promised himself. "How do we know that Mr. Rindich is responsible? It might have been anybody in the building, Jenkins." "I tell you it was him. Last night, when my missus went in with his evening meal, same as usual, she saw a length of that blind cord sticking out from under his bed, and there was a bit of green fluff on the coat hook, where the cord had frayed. The missus did a bit more nosing while she was clearing away, and she spotted the cat's collar in the waste paper basket. You couldn't hang a cat properly with that collar on, 'cause of the metal. She said the strap part had been cut, like as it might be with a razor." Miss Paisley gazed a second time into the ash can. The collar had certainly been removed. Jenkins, watching her, thought she was still unwilling to believe him. Like most habitual liars, he was always excessively anxious to prove his word when he happened to be telling the truth. "Come to think of it, the collar will still be in that basket," he said, mainly to himself. "Listen, he keeps it near enough to the front window. Come round to the front and maybe you'll be able to see it for yourself." The basket was of plated wicker. Through the interstitches, Miss Paisley could see enough of the collar to banish all doubt. She could listen to herself talking to Jenkins, just as she had been able to see herself standing at the ash can, knowing what was under the lid before Jenkins removed it. How easy it was to be calm when you made up your mind. The next day, Mr. Rendich is found murdered. Jenkins is arrested. Miss Paisley goes to the police and they don't believe her. Jenkins is convicted and scheduled to hang. But in this case, he has not yet been executed. Why has he already been executed in the episode? So that Miss Paisley won't look so bad if she decides not to go to the police after she discovers the truth. It is, after all, too late to save Jenkins. In this case, she considers Jenkins an abominable man. And when she finds the collar and remembers everything, the story finishes this way. Gone was the exultation which had sustained her in her first approach to the police. She stood up rigid as she had stood in the hall while listening to the scratching on the panel, refusing to accept an unbearable truth. Once again, she had the illusion of being locked up, aware now that there could be no escape from herself. There remained the collar, evidence irrefutable, but escapable. "If I keep this as memento, I shall soon get muddled and accuse myself of murder all over again. What was it that nice inspector said? If the brain can play one trick on you, it can play another." She smiled as she put the collar in her handbag, slipped on a coat, and walked, by the most direct route this time, to the 17th century bridge. She dropped the collar into the river, knowing that it would sink under the weight of its metal, unlike the blood-stained lumber jacket and the riding gloves, which Miss Paisley suddenly remembered she had weighted with stones scratched from the soil of the old cemetery. So in the story, Miss Paisley ultimately conceals her crime. We can't have that in the episode. It has to remain ambiguous, because Miss Paisley must remain the most sympathetic character in the episode. Roy Vickers, the author of the story, was born William Edward Vickers. And as the story indicates, he was born in England, where he was educated at Charterhouse School and left Brasenose College in Oxford without a degree. He studied law at the Middle Temple, but he never practiced. Instead, he worked as a journalist, as a court reporter, and as a magazine editor. Now, when Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine gives him second place in their first story contest, that's the first story of Roy Vickers published in Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. I assume either that or they stuck that handle on the wrong story, because in his career, he sold hundreds of nonfiction articles to newspapers and magazines, had over 60 crime novels and 80 short stories published under Roy Vickers, but also various pseudonyms such as David Durham, Sefton Kyle, and John Spencer. In 1934, his story The Rubber Trumpet was published, which was the first of 38 stories that featured the fictitious Department of Dead Ends. That was a fictional Scotland Yard division that held various objects from unsolved crimes. And the stories, like Columbo, revealed the murderer's identity at the start, and then a random object from the department's shelves later proved their guilt. In 1960, Roy edited the Crime Writers Association's anthology of short stories called Some Like Them Dead, and the Manchester Evening News called one of his collections one of the half-dozen successful books of detective short stories published since the days of Sherlock Holmes. Roy Vickers died in 1965 at the age of 76. This is the first of three Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes based on his short stories. His next is The Crocodile Case, episode 34 of season 3. Now, the day after Miss Paisley's Cat aired, December 23, 1957, Suspicion aired The Dark Stairway, which was apparently another live episode. It was directed by Don Medford, whom we saw as director early on in the first season with Triggers and Leash, episode 3, and Into Thin Air, Episode 5. He will also direct an episode of the 80s Alfred Hitchcock Presents, Deadly Honeymoon. And he seems to be the director of choice for the live episodes of Suspicion. This is his third. The previous two, Murder Me Gently and The Deadly Game, were also live episodes. IMDb doesn't have much to say about this episode. They don't even list who the writer is. But they do have this description. Following her cousin Stephen Potter's death in a mysterious fall down a stairway, Cora Applegate suspects Stephen's wife spooked, wife Madeline, of conspiring to kill him, along with the help of a handsome neighbor. As police investigate, the two women vie for control of Stephen's young son, who may be the sole witness to the, quote, accident, unquote. Now even that is a little bit confused, because in spite of the sentence reading that Cora suspects Stephen's wife spooked wife Madeline, I think Stephen's wife is wife Madeline. In any event, Madeline is played by a familiar face, Phyllis Thaxter, and Jack Klugman is listed as a cast member, but not given a character name in IMDb, so I suppose we can suspect that he was Stephen Potter. Cora is played by Marion Seldes, whom we will see in Design for Loving, Episode 6 of Season 4. And the son, Stevie, is played by Flip Mark, whom we will not see at all. Now, when I talked about The Man Who Knew Too Much in the podcast on The Diplomatic Corpse, I mentioned that it stemmed out of Hitchcock's interest in doing a Bulldog Drummond film. That association got me interested in other unrealized films that Hitchcock had at one time intended to do. There are a number of websites out there dealing with different unmade Hitchcock films, but none were as comprehensive as the list and the descriptions on the Hitchcock Zone. I was going to begin with the earliest one on that list, Goodnight Nurse, and talk about it a little bit. Unfortunately, for the second time in my experience, the Hitchcock Zone has disappeared from the web. The last time it was gone for a few weeks and then suddenly came back. But now it's been gone for over a month at the time of this recording, and I'm afraid we won't see it again. It's the only website that mentioned Goodnight Nurse at all, and so I checked the various books I use as reference, and the only one that seems to include it is Peter Aykroyd's Alfred Hitchcock, A Brief Life, in which he briefly says that Hitchcock wrote the treatment of a film comedy, Goodnight Nurse, which was never filmed. All that survive are 8 pages of perfectly handwritten notes. So that's that, unless, or until, the Hitchcock Zone comes back. As for Miss Paisley, she's quirky and cute, and bathed in old-world surroundings and charm, and the episode has that cheerful music at the end. That makes you feel like you just watched a comedy. But it is, in fact, a very nasty episode. There are 3 deaths that come about because Stanley enters Miss Paisley's window. None are shown, but all are terrible. Rinditch kills Stanley because Stanley gets into his room through his window, and all he really has to do is close the darn window. Miss Paisley uses that same window to get in and kill Rinditch, using Stanley's brutal attack method.
I can only say that it was fixed in my mind that I must get close and strike upwards.
The method Stanley used in another brutal moment not shown, his fight with the dog. And then finally, Jenkins is executed for a crime he did not commit. He may not have been a nice man, and he was a thief, but he doesn't deserve this. Miss Paisley sails through it all. She seems so sweet and nice, but she sets herself above all others. Stanley is an ugly cat.
What an ugly cat.
Mr. Rinditch is a vulgar man.
I know he's a bookmaker and a vulgar man.
The other people in the apartment building are not as vulgar as Rinditch, but in Miss Paisley's view, they are common.
The other people in this building are common. They cannot help that.
And Jenkins is a cruel man.
And Jenkins is a cruel man. I can see that now. He's always mocked me.
In fact, generally speaking, Miss Paisley has come to this conclusion.
People are dreadful, Stanley. Dreadful.
All of these views give her license to commit the murder she ultimately commits, even if she doesn't remember doing it. In the end, she kills to avenge Stanley, but not really for Stanley's sake, but for her own loss of companionship and her own loss of faith in people. So 6 months later, she still misses Stanley, but she thinks she may get a kitten that she can actually train.
I'm lonely, Stanley. I was used to it before you came, but now I'm lonely. Perhaps I'll get a kitten. A very young one that I can train.
She's sorry that Jenkins got blamed.
But it does seem a little hard on Jenkins. Undesirable as he is.
But really, as far as she's concerned, Jenkins' execution just brings on a better superintendent.
But the new superintendent is much nicer. Almost a gentleman, in fact.
Granted, she does initially go to the police and try to convince them that she committed the murder. But is this really because she wants to take responsibility for her actions and spare Jenkins? Or is it because she must cleanse herself of the spot on her person for which Papa would disapprove, in the same way that he would disapprove of the spot on her table?
Oh dear, there's a spot on the table. What would Papa have said?
Of course, she has already cleansed herself of that spot until the very end by refusing to remember exactly what she did to Mr. Rendich. All in all, in spite of the meekness of her manner, it seems that Miss Paisley isn't all that nice a person herself. So, does she go to the police at the end of the episode? I don't think so. And that's why we need Hitch to pin the blame on her, and also in his own way, to reveal her cruelty beneath that sweet veneer. He is now sitting on the butcher block, and my DVD has the alternate European outro. So I will take what I can and try to reconstruct the original. The opening is the same. Here's Hitch.
Unfortunately for Miss Paisley, murder will out. She was finally uncovered, chiefly through the efforts of the SPCH, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Humans. It's not a very powerful organization, but it's growing.
And now my sponsor would like to have his say, after which I shall sneak back. Alfred Hitchcock Presents Season 1 and Season 3, Rear Window, Vertigo, Them, The Twilight Zone, the complete second season, and The Outer Limits Season 2 are all available at the Ann Arbor District Library. The thriller episode, The Fatal Impulse, The Giant Gila Monster, the Space Patrol episode, Evil Spirits of Great Thunderbird, and the clip from Hell It Came are all available online. If you would like to contact me about this episode, please email me at sjoe@aadl.org. That's sjoerdsmaa@aadl.org. And please put Hitchcock somewhere in the subject line. Next time, episode 91, Night of the Execution, starring Pat Hingle and George Ann Johnson. I can think of no way I could top The Last Offering, so they let, and this is where he realizes he is sitting on the cleaver and pulls it out. That concludes tonight's entertainment. Next week, we shall be back again with another story.
Good night.
The ending of the alternate version is much nastier.
As for the star of our show, Miss Paisley's cat Stanley, he went down in the line of duty, making a revival of our play impossible. But all is not lost. He is being used for dog food.
It is here in this version that he realizes he is sitting on the meat cleaver.
And on this pleasant note, we conclude tonight's entertainment. Until next time, good night.